Hello and welcome to Animates, the program which brings you stories about animals and the many ways we connect with them. This program is recorded in the studios of 2RPH Sydney for the RPH Network. I'm Katie Brooks. Today, I will be bringing you an interview with Kevin Picker, the CEO of CSTDA. That's the Centre for Service and Therapy Dogs Australia, which is also known as Dogs for Life. This organisation trains dogs to help people with a wide variety of conditions, including autism, dementia, PTSD, anxiety, and seizures. Hello, Kevin. I've invited you on to Animates to talk about your organisation.
It's C for Centre, yes. S for Service, T for Therapy, D for Dogs, and A for Australia. We actually do go by the name Dogs for Life as well.
Oh, Dogs for Life. That's a lot easier to get your tongue around. So can you tell me about how the organisation first began?
The organisation was started close on 27 years ago by a gentleman by the name of Yariv Ben-Yosef, who's a fair legend in the industry. And I was looking for a dog for my son, who is very autistic. We looked around Australia. We weren't able to find somebody who we felt had the deep knowledge of autism. And we went overseas. We found Yariv. He came and delivered the dog to my son in a project, which was really successful. But more importantly, he fell in love with Australia and wanted to migrate here. And I said I would assist him and sponsor him and start a company to do that. And yes, that's where the company starts from in Australia. And now we're part of the global brand or the international group. But essentially we run in Australia as an independent organisation.
Now, I see that you're based in Victoria. What kind of area of Australia do you service?
To a large extent, it depends what the dog is going to be required for and what ongoing intervention is required with the participant. If it's something like post-traumatic stress or something where we require an intervention on a weekly basis, then we're working all over Australia in all the major centres. If ever it's something like an epilepsy or a medi-alert dog, where the participant is able to be involved in a more intensive program, then we actually work in far more rural areas as well. And there we deliver dogs all over Australia. We have from Darwin through to Perth or South Perth, and as well as international. We deliver dogs, especially epilepsy alert dogs. We deliver them all over the world.
Wow, that's amazing. That's interesting that you've got these international connections. How does that work?
We see ourselves as an international group. We deliver dogs everywhere from America to South Africa to Israel. We have folks following our programs in Israel now, in Germany. We're just busy working with someone to start a research program in London. We see what we're doing and having been proven in Australia, and we do a lot of research here with La Trobe University. We see this as being a jump-off point to take what we do and to spread it to as many different places as we can. And
that does seem to be quite an interesting thing about your organisation. You train dogs to perform several different functions. How is that managed, that you're getting a dog for epilepsy, a dog for PTSD, a dog for autism? You've got all these different strands, it seems.
Yeah, we try not to look at the disability or the name. Our organisation trains dogs to assist people in their journey towards empowerment. And we see that very simply. The naming or the grouping or the labelling of people by their disability diagnosis is sometimes very limiting, and it indicates what they cannot do. But if we look at the person holistically and you look at see what prevents their empowerment, and that's what we use the dog for, and then it becomes far more simple. We run a fairly rigid psychosocial program which examines people or looks at people from an empowerment perspective in various domains, see where they are deficient or where they're not able to achieve empowerment in a particular element, in a particular domain. And then we work with the dog and we work with them to address that challenge.
So how does that program work? Do people just kind of apply to be part of it or?
Well, they apply for a dog, and we don't believe giving somebody a dog in isolation is valid. Now, that's our belief. It's not right or wrong. Many people do different things in Australia, but we believe that an animal-assisted program together with the animal is the way to go. And we would use a therapist to deliver the program. So a therapist with someone with a cognitive challenge is fantastic. A dog with somebody with a cognitive challenge is fantastic. But a dog and a therapist together with that person with a cognitive challenge is greater than the sum of the parts. And then the participant takes that dog, but they've been trained on how to use that dog. And not just trained how to make the dog sit down, come and stay, but rather how to use that dog to challenge their cognitive shortcomings, if that makes sense.
So these therapists, they're trained in what sort of a field? Are they animal people, psychologists? What
no,
are they?
Psychologists, occupational therapists. Peer counsellors are a very big thing for us. We think peer counselling is very good for folks with anxiety, depression. In the case, for instance, of Epilepsy Alert, where we're looking more for the alerting section of a dog, they need more animal skills. So the animal side of that program is more weighted. But it depends. Each program, although they're following the same psychosocial program, which is proprietary, which is something that we've defined, every program's completely different because obviously every person is completely different.
Another area that you seem to work in is aging and dogs associated with that.
We work with folks with dementia. It's very, very positive for us. We get great results, especially with Alzheimer's. If we can work with somebody early enough so that they're able to absorb the program and absorb how to use the dog, then the dog can be an absolutely spectacular partner in aging. If you think about it, the dog is completely non-judgmental. She will take you out every day. You'll have to go for a walk with your dog. And she's a conduit to communication, so you meet somebody in the road, you can talk. But more importantly, we train the dog that if you're starting to get anxious, confused, or maybe getting lost, and the dog will then lead you home or lead you to your last port of safety. So we train the dog that when somebody gets anxious, and obviously we have a way of training the dog how to pick that up, then the dog will take the lead. So indeed, the lead then changes, and that's why we're always looking at the symbiotic relationship between person and dog. And if you trust your dog and you allow the dog to take you, the dog will actually lead you home. So you can then go out with complete confidence.
Obviously, dementia can deteriorate. Is there processes in place for when the person deteriorates to a point where they can't manage a dog anymore?
One of the big issues that we have is we call it support, program support. Everybody requires program support, and the same with dementia. When the person or the participant is no longer able to cope with it, will manage the dog independently, then they need their support team to look after the dog, but to continue to use the dog for them. So the dog will continue to sleep with them. The dog will continue to sit with them. It's very important that this is an area of stability that the person with dementia is able to hold on to and base themselves on the entire time. The disease does progress after that. As soon as the dog finished its point of being able to base and ground somebody, which is very close to him, then the dog generally is accepted by the family as almost a memory of their relative who's going to pass away.
That's an interesting way of thinking about it.
It works very well. So because the dog becomes an essential element in the family, in the support environment.
You mentioned families there, and I was seeing on your website you talk a lot about your philosophy of working with whole families. Could you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Every person requires a support network, a support environment, a support infrastructure. Our aim is to make the dog part of that infrastructure and to use that infrastructure to work with the dog and the participant. So let's take, for instance, somebody with PTSD. Maybe a veteran comes back with PTSD. It's very, very difficult for them to relate to their family. Extremely difficult to relate to their children. part of our program is to reintegrate them into the family structure and to use that family structure together with the dog to support them. That reintegration or that reestablishment of that connection is very, very important in the program and very important in the process. We see the support structure as being an important element in the person's journey towards empowerment. It may not be a traditional family. It could be mates. It could be other support people. But the support environment is very important. Our cohort of folks generally are ill. It's difficult. They're not always able to cognitively partake. And in those cases, they actually do need support in order to get going.
You also seem very conscious of the welfare of the dogs as they're training and the environment they'll be going into and all that sort of thing, don't you?
One of the main aims of support is to make sure that the dog is well. We actually see the dog as a partner in this process. There cannot be an area where the dog is not working of free will or wanting to work. Think about our cohort of participants are not always able to cognitively give the dog a command. So if you're looking at somebody who suffers with anxiety, when they become very anxious and they're going to be having an anxiety attack, they're not cognitively able to tell the dog to help them or to sit down, come stay. Yep. The dog's got to want to do it. So the dog can never be afraid of them. The dog can never be afraid of an environment. So all of the training of the dog is positive. All of the training of the dog does not take account only of the environment. There is no negative input at all. We do not punish a dog in any way, shape, or form. The only thing that we do with a dog is we encourage good behavior, appropriate use of their instincts, and we discourage or we ignore the inappropriate instinct. If you think about somebody with uncontrolled seizures, we can't be telling the dog every 2 minutes, you must look for a seizure. What we train the dog to do is to use her instincts to always look for the seizure because that's what she wants to do. That's her aim, that's her game, that's her enjoyment, that's her life. So there's no requirement for our participants to be giving strong verbal training. And we disagree with that completely. We do not believe that in our cohort, anyone's dog should be command or instruction dependent. When we go into a restaurant with our dogs, obviously everyone says, you must go down immediately. That's not true. Maybe the handler is about to have a seizure and the dog needs to be on a level with them that the dog can sense it, can see them, can smell them, can taste them. So the dog has got to lead in that. What's important is the dog must be comfortable in the restaurant, so she's able to do that. She mustn't create a public nuisance of herself, but she's still got to work.
Where do you get these dogs from that you train up to help all these people?
We work with breeders that are around Australia. We believe that these are amongst the best breeders in Australia. Obviously, the breeder's got to be out of the top drawer. But more importantly, their line has got to be out of the top drawer. So we monitor their breeding line because we're looking for dogs that have the correct instinct to do the job and the correct physical makeup to do the job and the correct fur or skin or weight, that type of thing, because every client requires a different dog. Every challenge may require a different instinct. We have an agreement with our providers once they become a preferred vendor of ours that we get the first choice of the litter. Then each of these vendors actually has very specific whelping requirements. So our dogs have to be whelped in a certain way and they've got to be looked after in a certain way and stimulated in a certain way right from 6 weeks.
So and, are they particular breeds that you favour?
Obviously, we don't have any protective dogs whatsoever or any aggressive dogs or any dangerous dogs. Then we're looking for the dogs of the right sizes. We use Labradors, Golden Retrievers, Standard Poodles, King Charles Cavaliers, Ligottas are a very good one, especially for autism. And all of those breeds have different instincts that we need for different things. And we actually have two different lines of Labradors. One of them is a very good line for anxiety. Another one's a very good line for autism. So different dogs have different instincts, and what we try and do is to maintain those instincts. So we can't take a dog and try and train her against her instincts. It can never work.
I'd noticed in your biography that you have a background in accounting, so this is probably quite a different thing that you've now taken on, isn't it?
I'm completely different. When Yariv came and I sponsored him, I realised that I had a responsibility, and I was retiring from my profession as of an accountant, and I was very involved in international information technology finance. When I retired, I volunteer, and this is my role in my retirement. We all give back, and this is what I'm doing.
If people were interested in your organisation, learning more about it, possibly even applying for a dog, you have a website?
Our website is dogsforlife.com.au or cstda.com.au. We do look the entire time for professional people, allied health folks that want to become involved. We run formal training programs with what we do. We're very transparent. We want to get as many people involved in the industry as we can, because it is very different to the regular assistance dog industry in Australia. We understand that. We push the envelope as to what the dog can do. And for someone who wants to be eligible for a dog, then we do have an application form, and we'll do an assessment. There's no cost to the assessment. One of our therapists will come out and meet with them and do a chat with them. One of our psychs will have a session with them. And yes, that's how we work.
You were saying there about you push the envelope in how you deal with dogs. In what regard is that?
If we take seizure alert, we don't really know what the dog's picking up on. Because every person is different and all seizures are different, we're pushing the dog to become more accurate in what they're doing and to be looking for the earlier sign. Now, we don't know what that sign is, so our trainers are working with the dogs almost blind. Seizure dogs today that are available are generally called seizure response dogs. So this is a dog that's going to respond once you start having a seizure.
Yeah.
We're pushing that envelope further. We're saying, okay, not only do we want the dog to respond, but we want the dog to alert you, and not just 30 seconds before, but we want the dog to alert you up to 5 minutes before. And then we push that response further. And this is what we're doing now, and we have this dog recovery. So not only do we want the dog to help you to recover, but we want the dog to interrupt cluster seizure. So we're working in depth with how the dog should detect a cluster seizure while you're having a seizure and interfere with your seizure just before the cluster starts. That's one example. Possibly the most important thing to understand is that in our life and for our cohort, that dog sometimes is the difference between life and death or life and injury. And certainly the difference between wellness and not being well. It's become almost critical. A lot of our folks can't leave their bedrooms without their dog. A lot of our folks can't walk outside because they may have a seizure. A lot of our folks can't shower without their dog around. We have one participant who has uncontrolled seizures who was having a baby, and the doctors waited for the dog to be relaxed before they started the procedure. They didn't want to take a chance of her having a seizure during the procedure. We have a young lady who was interviewed on the television just a couple of nights ago who says quite openly that without the dog, she wouldn't be here, inferring that she wouldn't be alive because her seizures are so violent and she gets hospitalized very often. They can give the medication prior to the seizure and reduce the severity of the seizure and make sure that the person is safe before a seizure. So what we're doing is taking the service dog into another realm, to take this assistance dog for someone with cognitive challenges into another area altogether.
It's so fascinating. There's so many different services that your organisation provides, and I wish you luck with it.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you for being on our program.
No worries. Take care.
If you missed those contact details for Kevin Picker and his organisation, it's www.cstda.com.au. Just repeating, that's www.cstda.com.au. Or alternatively, www.dogsforlife.com.au. one word together, .com.au. And again, that's www.dogsforlife, or one word, .com.au. That brings us to the end of another episode of Animates. This program was recorded in Sydney by 2RPH for the RPH Network. Researched by Joseph Schwanzer, and I'm Katie Brooks. Please join us again next time for more stories of animals and their mates.